Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. It is June 23rd, 2016, day 10 of E3, and it is episode 482. I'm joined today by Mr. John Lindemann.
AKA Breath of the Wind.
Oh, it's going to be so many. So Call of the Wild is the one I'm looking forward to.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't specify what type of wind.
I assumed. Mr. Greg Lay.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
And Mr. Guillaume Bayet.
I'm just glad that John didn't go with Skyward Sword.
That's a bit presumptive of him to call himself the Skyward Sword, isn't it, John?
I am laying down on the bed, but...
Great.
Shameless.
Well, to be fair, John is also from the beginning of all timelines, so it actually would fit pretty well.
Oh, boy. Already on the rails.
I mean, since when have we had an episode start on the rails in the last 6 months? Basically, since I took over the show, every intro has just been like a calamity. A slow-rolling train into the Grand Canyon, filled with puppies and orphans. The train, not the Grand Canyon. That would be a lot of puppies and orphans. And I don't want to think about what would have to happen to create that many orphans. But, episode titled, Not That Many Orphans. That's probably not going to happen. Okay, but it is time for new business. And it's weird because we are officially in the summer of Too Hot for Games. And there's a weird problem here. There are too many games.
Seriously.
Yeah, that's so I've talked about this on off air. This is the part of the summer where it's too hot for James. You've got some big hitters coming in quick succession for you.
God, if Ace Attorney 6 had come out this month too, I would have to quit work. It's new business time, and I'm going to go first because I have a game that Nintendo didn't want you to know about. It's called Rhythm Heaven Mega Mix. And when I say they didn't want you to know about it, they never talked about it, and then suddenly it was out in the middle of E3 while everybody was drooling over Breath of the Wild, so... Way to be, Nintendo. But it's Rhythm Heaven on my 3DS, and I adore this series. Like, this is, of my video game, like, the pantheon of video game series, it's up in, like, the top five. And every time one of these games comes out, it's an event for me. And I would have probably already beaten it pretty convincingly, except I spent 4 days in total darkness because of an awesome power outage. Basically the day the game came out, so that was fun. But, I now have it, and I am deep into this game, and it is, if you have not been following the no news Nintendo has put out about this game, Rhythm Heaven Megamix is, basically, it's kind of a best of the Rhythm Heaven series. There are a handful of new games, but it's primarily sort of a redistribution of these various games throughout the series history. So the original Game Boy Advance game, the DS game, and the Wii game. I personally think that the Wii game is up there is one of the finest games ever made in the genre. So the 3DS game has a hard bar to climb over, and it doesn't, but it doesn't seem like it was ever the objective of the team making Rhythm Heaven Megamix to, you know, go beyond what the Wii game does. Because I feel like that game kind of delivers, you know, that is sort of maximally what you can do with the franchise. It is well put together. All the music's incredible. Most of the mini games are really good. There's no like one or two outliers where you go, man, fuck that game. And it's just a really well put together package. This, because of its sort of clip show nature, isn't quite as consistent a package. It isn't bundled together as tightly. The presentation isn't quite there, although all the introductions for all of the games, all of the games themselves, they all look very nice, very sharp. The 3D is done quite well in a relatively limited way. And of course, the art in the series is unbelievable. It's always, always fun, cartoony nonsense. Lots of different styles are experimented with. Lots of creative looking characters and fun imagery. It is, you know, it is one of the most creative looking games Nintendo produces. However, and I say that, Rhythm Heaven Megamix being this kind of, it's weird for me to say this is a handheldized version of the Wii game, considering this is a handheld driven series. You know, the DS game was the first game to come out in the West. The GBA game was the first game in the series. And of course, those are both handhelds. The Wii game, being a console experience, had these kind of long... Let me take a step back. One of the things I immediately took away as I was playing Mega Mix is how short a lot of the games are. And, you know, from a WarioWare standpoint, that makes a lot of sense. But with these games that are like basically trying to push out a riff of music, sometimes they feel claustrophobically short. Like you do, a lot of times the game has essentially two things you do in it, and, you know, it's one thing with two variants. And a lot of times these things are so short that once you've done the, you do the primary one, then you do the variant once or twice, and then it's over. And it's, they're so compact, presumably to get it into more portable play experience, that it doesn't feel like you ever really get in to one of the, to one of the games. Some of the simpler ones where you're doing the same thing a bunch of times, that's easier. But the ones where they're more complicated, like there's a new one where you're controlling a chameleon's tongue. Like that one's actually got some length to it, but you really don't get a good feel for it until the song's almost over. Then you have to roll it again. But also you control a chameleon's tongue and eat bugs. This game is nuts. You play as a...
To be clear, that's the thing. I mean, there are... Basically, the games are split into four. You know, there are the games from the original, games from DS, games from Wii, and then new ones. It is it is, as the title would suggest, a mix of all the games in the series. But you have got, you know, a sort of equal representation of new games too.
To new games to each of the three counterparts.
It's not 50-50, but it is a fourth of the, you know, there's been four games, a fourth of these are new, kind of thing.
Yep. And the way it sort of puts these together, historically, the Rhythm Heaven series has put together essentially these blocks that ended with a remix. So it'd be, what, usually like five or six games and then a remix that combines elements of all of them. This one does a little bit differently, and possibly because of speaking to a budgetary constraint on this game, essentially you get this diorama pop-up with this completely insane character, like a dude who wears a hat shaped like a donut, who speaks lovingly about handsome donuts, but won't let you eat them because they're too handsome to eat. And then he kind of like flees over every donut as you complete chapters, as you complete the four songs that make up his stage, and they pop sort of into existence on this diorama. It's kind of this weird parade of characters that have really mundane problems that they want solved in completely asinine ways. You know, there's one where it's a restaurant and he bills himself as the world's greatest chef, but there's no food in the restaurant. So each mini game you clear brings in more items into his stage. And then at the end, of course, it's revealed he's actually just the guy who buys groceries. He's not actually a chef. So you can go to the next set of stages now, though. And it's just kind of this progression through this kind of pop-up book visual versus the big block of remixes, which means at the end, there's no remix to go with it, which is a bummer. Because for me, that's one of my favorite parts of the Rhythm Heaven games. Remix 9 and 10 in Rhythm Heaven Fever are some of the...
You get your shot of remixes, trust me.
Do you?
Eventually, okay. Yeah. I mean, if you deeper into the game, you would have started to see them. They start coming along, and that's the thing. Like I said, a quarter of the constituent games are new, but then, of course, all the remixes are kind of new, even though they're going to use... You know, some of those old games as components of the remix. So, you know, that kind of adds to the freshness of it as well. And some of those are still excellent. I mean, like you'll be wishing the last remix is shorter if you're trying to get a perfect on it. Let's put it that way.
I did notice that the game scores a little bit differently than some of the other Rhythm Heaven games.
It's more granular now.
Yeah. Which is a little weird, because there are a couple where that perfect is incredibly tight. And there's these star badges that you get.
You hit it, you get it's kind of like a loop. Each song has like an achievement, essentially, is getting one particular beat right that they've identified as the star beat or whatever. Yeah. So you get kind of, I don't know, and you can sort of see the star coming in. Right. On the lower screen, so it kind of builds you up for like this is the moment where you're gonna want to get it right to the extent that you care about that.
But in the previous games, the window was a little bit wider for perfect versus near hit versus miss.
Like I said, now it's a little bit different, because like I said, I mean, you could get a perfect badge on a game.
Oh,
but score 90 odd. It's not 100. Like I said, because it's got more granular. It's like, well, basically, if you hit the beat almost perfectly, you know, that will count as hitting it, and you know that will not break the perfect chain if you go in for that on a particular song. However, like I said, you know, in terms of the scoring system, the number that you get at the end, that it's got down to this super kind of granular level where it's like, yeah, you know, if you are absolutely exactly on it every single time, it would be 100, you know, which is I mean, I've got perfects on everything and I've not hit 100 in any individual song.
That
kind of highlights, you know, the level of precision that would take.
Right. And so sometimes it can be really frustrating when the star beat is like a combo of things and that window for the exact perfect beat is so tiny. It's like that. It seems like some of these are almost impossible. A good example is
they're not, trust me.
do you have them all?
I have all the star beats. I have all the perfects. It's you know, it's very much in the same, I think difficulty wise, ultimately it's in the same ballpark as the Wii game. It's just, you've got the sort of different, you know, slightly different elements to the way they're kind of not only assessing your performance, but kind of giving you feedback about it. Because the way they use the lower screen, where you can actually see represented whether you're early or late on a beat, for instance, I think it could be quite helpful. You know, so that's so sometimes like you might be kind of actually scrape it by in terms of you're not actually getting it quote unquote wrong, but you could see in fact you are still like early all the time, so you're kind of, you know, you're a little bit way, or you know, a little bit off all the time, so that if you kind of make a mistake further in that direction, then it is going to be a problem, so you can look to correct that and stuff. I think it's a nice way. I know some people with the older Rhythm Heaven games talked about like, well, I kind of don't really know how I got it wrong or all that. I think this does provide more feedback, and people hopefully will be able to kind of get to grips with it if they are kind of struggling at first.
Oh, there's definitely more visibility into what the problem was. It's just sometimes like, because it's so granular, you know, you're slightly early, but there's not much you can do about it.
Yeah, like I said, it's best not to obsess over it, because I got to a point where you get perfects on everything, I still can't get much over 95 on any individual song. You know, I mean, don't go full OCD on this thing.
I won't. It's very easy to do that with these games, because it's weird. The ramp up is super slow in this one. Like the first,
yeah, the first rounds of things are very, very easy. Again, you know, it seems like it's easing people in a little more than maybe the other games did.
Then there's just a switch. It's like, you are not getting perfects anymore. Have a good time. And it feels very discreet. Unlike I'm used to the game kind of having a nice difficulty curve. But this one's just like, yo, all right. Practice is over, guys. Let's go.
Yeah, it's kind of like a prologue, really, where you have like old games, but with new music.
Right.
Which is odd, because later on, it's just, you know, old games and new games that have new music as well. It's this weird sort of, almost like a prologue, kind of introductory phase to the game. I've no idea how that's explained in the story, because I played it Japanese, but I don't imagine it's terribly important.
The dude with the bear with an afro fell from heaven world and wants to get back, but to get there he needs to climb up a mountain that doesn't seem particularly high, and then he essentially insists you walk with him. Like, that's the story premise here. I mean, this game is just nonsense. And it's kind of a beautiful nonsense, but it is definitely nonsense. What I'm curious about, though, is I don't think there's a lot of vocal music in this game.
Oh, there's some, including a track, one of the remixes, which evidently you've not got to yet, is a track where Sunku's daughter is sings on it.
I'm curious what they did with the language stuff, because...
Well, no, but she sings in English. That's the funny thing. In the Japanese version, we have this little Japanese girl singing in English. So I assume they wouldn't have changed that.
God damn it.
Yeah, there are... I'm trying to think. There must be some... yeah, vocal songs. Localization. I'm not sure how they would handle it.
There's the one with the boards, the hoverboards, where you have to jump.
Yeah,
over
I mean,
because
some of those obviously were already localized, like the frogs from the DS game and all that. Yeah. Like, you know, they already localized that. So yeah, I imagine they would have kept the localized versions in. I'm just trying to think of where they already existed. I'm just trying to think of cases where there's vocals on new games or remix, and that one remix I can think of happens to be a Japanese girl singing in English, so that is not
perfect.
Helpful.
So yeah,
sorry.
I mean, there is kind of a budget to this game in a lot of ways, and Nintendo's localization efforts or bringing it to the West seems to have double down on the budgetiness of it. But it is. I'm complaining in a way because I'm holding this game up to a near a game that I almost gave a 10. And I've only almost given a game 10 twice. And I talked to John both times, and both times he's like, dude, don't.
God, it is not 1.5 points better than The Conduit or whatever. It's just...
It's not quite there.
At best, you watch your full mouth. Point better.
You watch your mouth or Space Lincoln will come for you. I'm still really enjoying this game. I mean, I wasn't really
it,
able...
it sounds to me like you'll enjoy it a fair bit more as you really get to the meat of it. The remixes are always my favorite part of these games, and they are backloaded basically. For whatever reason, like I said, maybe it's part of the remixes kind of overwhelming for people, so they take a while. I don't know what the feedback is.
Instead, you get these challenges where it's like, hey, you could pick three tiers of difficulty, flip a quarter 15 times.
Yeah, like they are rhythm based, but they really are mini games rather than songs. You know,
yes.
So they're still based on your sense of timing, but yeah, they're a bit weird. They're the kind of thing that have been in past Rhythm Heaven games, but usually just on the side. Here, they just sort of come in every now and again as like a little test. Just to slow down your progression, which is
Because if you have to bet coins, and if you run out of coins, guess what? Go play the mini games again.
Yeah, go back and sort of grind for coins if you had to.
That's happened, but
it's a little odd. They weren't really much of an impediment to me, but I'm not sure what purpose they serve other than that. So
I only failed one so far, and that was the coin flipping one on the hardest difficulty on the very last coin flip, and I was like, I'm done. I'm out. I'll see y'all later. Because 15 coin flips is not what I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, that's pretty dumb.
But it is a really fun game. Like I said, I picked it up last night and then went and played for I went to bed at 4 in the morning. I have a problem.
Ashamed of yourself, James. I mean,
just in general, yeah, it's fine. But it's a really cool game. And if you've not played a Rhythm Heaven game, I absolutely encourage you to play this game.
Oh, yeah, because what you're getting here as well, so if we talk about the fact that a quarter of it is original plus, all the remix stuff, so arguably more than a quarter. But, you're talking about 100 games. It's probably almost twice the size of a regular Rhythm Heaven game.
It is, yeah.
So if you've never played one before... This is a real buffet of Rhythm Heaven goodness. The only question is just whether you will get into it. I got into it 10 years ago. So I took to this like a duck to water when I imported it last year. But, I will say I think it's easier than ever because of the extra feedback and all that and the kind of gentle intro. So,
agreed.
Obviously it's there on the eShop for everyone as well. It's not difficult to find or anything. So I guess the only thing is price. So how much did it come out for in the States?
$29.99.
Seems a thoroughly reasonable value proposition to me. But as I said last week, I imported it. So I'm not really the best person to say.
Yeah, I would, if you've played the other Rhythm Heaven games, this is still a really good Rhythm Heaven game. But I would say, just decide if having it on the go matters a lot to you or if you're just ready for more of it. Otherwise, it doesn't stand out so much that I would say, if you're just a casual fan of the series, you have to have this entry. I think the Wii game is that pinnacle of the franchise. But if you like the series a lot and you just want to have more of it, or you like the idea of having it on the go, because like I said, these are shorter in general songs, then yeah, this is a pretty good package, and I would encourage picking it up, even if Nintendo of America apparently doesn't really. So, regardless. All right, so, Greg.
Yes. Yeah, so my new business this week, I have been, I've basically polished off Kirby, but I think I'll hold further comment on that maybe till next week. I've got 96% on the completion file. I don't think that extra 4% is going to materially affect my opinion of the game, which is generally very favourable. But I want to focus on Fire Emblem Fates Conquest, as it turns out, because I finished it today. I wasn't sure I would, but I finished it today, so my head's full of thoughts about that, so we may as well go all in on that.
Do it.
So yeah, I mean, obviously it came out in Europe months after it did in the States, so it's not the hottest topic, but you know, I kind of followed from, you know, when James talked about Birthright, I, you know, expressed the fact I would probably go Conquest, based on, you know, what James was saying and all the reviews and all this kind of stuff, and just my own personal kind of preferences and all that, and that is what I did. I bought a physical copy of Conquest. And so, you know, playing it now, obviously I have not played Birthright to offer the direct comparison is the thing, is the tricky thing about it. But, you know, obviously I did play Awakening quite a bit. So comparing it to that, I have to say, you know, it did seem to me that the map designs were more interesting. The objectives were more interesting. Ultimately, I feel like I made the right decision because, you know, I mean, I guess to give the full context, I went with normal classic. So kind of low difficulty, but the permadeath in effect. Because, you know, I'm not that much of an expert at strategy games at all, but I do kind of like the tension that exists when you want to keep the characters alive like this, but at the same time you need to develop them. You know, I mean, it's all well and good trying to just, you know, lead with your absolute toughest units and all that, but then you're not going to end up with a very well-rounded party if you do that. So, you know, you need to you know, put your lesser units out there to kill enemies and get experience. So we talked about this in some of the retroactives we've done about strategy games, you know, it especially holds true in the case of Conquest, because you don't have the access to those sort of extra battles that you can sort of pay to set up, where you can essentially kind of grind for experience. You know, money is limited, battles are limited. You know, so these are scarce resources to be managed in themselves, you know, and that's the thing. I mean, I did a lot of restarting, but it wasn't all the time about because I made a mistake and got a unit killed. Sometimes it would play out and it's like, well, the battle's going all right, but all the experience is accruing to my toughest units. And, you know, I'm not that happy about that because, you know, my party's going to be really unbalanced. And if you get a certain kind of objective later on where, you know, maybe just having a handful of really strong units is not, you know, strategically that helpful, I might be in a bit of trouble there. So, you know, I would kind of try and devise, you know, refine the strategy a little bit that I was using to be able to get more of the other units involved and accruing experience while still, of course, you know, trying to keep them alive for the most part. So, you know, that kind of stuff, I think, was appealed to me. You know, those sorts of strategic decision making kind of problems. And then, as I said, the maps, as it went on, especially maybe just at the very end, they got a little bit more sort of typical. But, you know, kind of that sort of late middle of the game has some really interesting maps, I felt, like the sort of escape sequence up this giant flight of stairs with your spawning enemies coming from the bottom to get you all the time, or a great sequence where you're taking a wall. You have to sort of siege a wall and claim it from the other side, which that was really fun, trying to sort of crack how to do that without losing a bunch of enemies involved, or me setting up a little kind of, you know, flying squadron to sort of drop a few units in and have them take out their defenses, you know, because it got to a point where it was very well balanced. You know, they'd have magic users and physical users and anti-air units all clustered together. So you couldn't just drop one kind of unit in and have them clean up, you know, and involved like warping units in and out and all this kind of stuff. It just that was a lot of fun, that kind of you know, problem solving. And as far as I'm aware, that is not really in Birthright to a great degree, is it, James?
Not really. Generally speaking, Birthright creates difficulty by just, here are a shit ton of enemies, deal with it. It's not anything particular about this configuration of enemies, it's just there are a lot of them. And that often means you end up kiting groups of enemies away and just sort of jumping on them sort of guerrilla warfare style, and then sort of advancing with this kind of piecemeal, go up a little bit, offer bait, bring the enemy back to your main formation, jump them like you're taking them in the back alley, and then go forward.
Yeah, so, I mean, like I said, this is the odd mission that's somewhat like that, I guess. But, yeah, there's a good variety here, and definitely the use of the, I assume, yeah, this is something that is in Birthright as well, as a general sort of mechanic, but the whole dragon vein element of the game, where there's certain spots on the map which allow you to activate environmental features or certain sort of conditions, you know, that can really affect the battle. You know, some of those are some really quite interesting sort of ways of using this. We'll be sort of trapped in a dungeon, and the dragon vein points control which of the sort of walls within the dungeon are locked or not. And, you know, sort of like getting it all right. So it's like, well, I got to get all these particular units on the right side of that wall and then leave someone behind to shut the door after them. But, you know, not in such a way that they've been hung out to dry and are going to die. You know, these sorts of things. I really, really enjoyed it. Like I said, I have to say I enjoyed it more than Awakening, which I enjoyed a great deal. So I think it's a pretty sound recommendation from me in that regard. Story-wise, yeah, I probably would maybe give it an edge over Awakening on this path, even though I kind of feel the game is a very appropriate size in terms of the number of levels, the variety they've got in there. You know, it doesn't feel stretched out. The story feels stretched out. It feels kind of like, you know, they didn't really have enough sort of beats in the story to put it over this many chapters.
And I wonder if that's the challenge of having to write three stories, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, there are very clearly elements of it that are deliberately unresolved.
Right.
You know, with the you know, very obvious name of Revelations for the, you know, third campaign.
Yeah.
You know, that's
a little on the nose there, gentlemen.
Yeah, if you're looking for those answers, then you know, presumably that's where they're to be found. But you know, in general, it works, you know, fairly well as its own story. You know, and it's got the conclusion is not entirely unsatisfying or anything like that. It's just there's very obvious elements, threads within the story that just aren't addressed very much. But you know, that's what the DLC is for, I guess, if you're really interested in that. You know, if you look at reviews and all that kind of stuff, there's a lot of praise for the Revelation path, the Revelation campaign, that it might be the best of the lot. So, you know, it's the kind of thing I'd be interested in looking at eventually, not so much for the story stuff, but just, you know, if it really is kind of the, you know, maybe the something that adds to it what you've already done in the other games, but not for now, I don't think. I've played it quite a lot over the past few weeks, in a pretty concentrated time. I think it'll be a little while before I move on to that, but, you know, I was definitely ready for this, given that, you know, it'd been, you know, quite, what was it, 3 years since Awakening.
Roughly.
Yeah, I don't think I will wait 3 years to download Revelation, but maybe sometime.
I mean, I'm sort of at the point where I'm ready to go at Conquest now, but, you know, I did need a pretty significant break. And, you know, there's kind of, the thing about these games is there's a sort of tension to them that's a little bit different, because it's not like, am I going to make this jump tension? It's kind of this long play tension of, am I going to F this up really bad? And it's a long stretch, maybe an hour, maybe 2 hours of like, I need to do this correctly.
Especially the later in the game it gets,
yeah,
the more drawn out they get. Like I said, sometimes you could recognize that, you know, a certain, you know, linchpin moment in the battle sort of hinged on them missing when they could easily have hit or something.
Or they could have criticaled or something.
You get a critical that was, you know, hugely beneficial that, you know, you're not going to necessarily repeat. So
right.
You really do not want to mess this up because you're in an unusually advantageous situation.
Yes.
So that is real tension.
And there's something about playing one of those games for 20 to 30 hours. You're like, I need to step away from this game for a while. And I think I'm finally coming back around to the point where I could pick up Conquest, but.
So what are you thinking about, you know, doing the three or just...
Yeah.
Rather than going straight to Revelation, because that's probably... It doesn't seem like there's that much use in me going to Birthright, to be honest.
No, Birthright probably is the most amenable outcome for the game, but, like, in terms of just, like, how the characters present themselves, because you're with the good Japanese people. I'm sorry, the Hoshidens. This game's not made in Japan. Just remember that the Japanese people are super nice all the time.
It is. It's kind of nice to see them actually have, like, Japanese culture represented so explicitly in a Fire Emblem.
Yeah. Oh, it is.
Because it kind of changes it up from the usual. Well, the ones I played didn't really kind of do that in the same way.
Yeah, I just don't know when I'm going to have the appetite for this game because... So, we just finished Seventh Dragon. Sharp FE just came out.
Oh,
today
it's quite a few RPGs coming out.
The RPG storm continues.
The drought is over.
The RPG storm continues forever.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I mean, we're still in the maelstrom. I mean, I thought the maelstrom ended, but no.
No.
I get
no.
I'm always the eye of it.
It's
John,
not really.
John,
it's,
they
it's,
always call me the maelstrom.
It's more of a.
I'm not into you though, James.
Damn right.
It's not so much like a sort of passing weather system. It's more like Game of Thrones season. Like it's gonna last years.
RPG winter is coming. Already here.
It's firmly set in. I always have a sort of association with Game of Thrones with Fire Emblem because I remember when I beat Awakening, it was Battle of the Blackwater. When I beat this, it was Battle of the Bastards. So
nice.
They're always going to be sort of indelibly associated with my mind. And Garon, the king of Nor, is a bit mad king. Seems like he could say burn them all at any moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he seems like he would fit in that universe. In fact, in that universe, people might go, he's kind of a dick. Like, yeah. Yes, but
he would be low on the totem pole of dickery in Game of Thrones.
It's true.
He's nowhere near.
But there's only so much of a dick you can be and still get a teen rating.
True. Yeah. Absolutely. It's although you know, he seemingly wants you to do some pretty bad stuff a lot of the time, and that's the kind of one noteness I'm talking about with the story a lot of the time. It's like he wants you to do bad thing. You don't want to do bad thing. You have to subvert it. You are partially successful. That pretty much plays out for the main thrust of the story.
Fair enough.
You know, and like I said, I feel like it does kind of hit that beat a few too many times. But I still like the story. It worked in that sense. But okay, it does seem like, you know, it's difficult to escape the feeling that the revelation is essentially like the true path or whatever, like the...
Right,
yeah, the canon ending or whatever, like kind of thing. So, yeah, it'd be interested to see how much more satisfying that story would be. But I'm not.
I think it'll be more satisfying if you go download the Hot Spring DLC, and and the other related opportunities to ship with your brothers and sisters. I think you'll
feel
better off. Yeah, I
had three. I had three couples. That's all I managed to make. You know,
really.
Not, you know, Conquest was all work. You know, this is business. We're not.
Yeah, I guess
about grinding to get couples together. Or all that. You know, no time for love in a sort of very unhappy sort of grim kingdom like Nor. You know, it's
true.
But
not having the child characters seems like
I still had you know three child characters. And one of them proved to be weirdly useful in support. So I was glad that entirely accidental romance yielded such a useful character.
Don't that's what we say about John. Anyway,
weirdly useful
Greg.
Children is my motto.
All right, John, I need you to tell me about some Hawa.
Yeah, so been playing a little bit of Halo Wars 2 beta, which went live at E3, because that's the place. So, it's the place to drop bombs, yo.
It's true.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting for me just because this is kind of outside of my wheelhouse, even though it is Halo, which is, you know, cat helmet territory for me. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty much Halo StarCraft, and that's really not usually the kind of game I play.
On a console,
really on PC though, either. I don't play StarCraft on PC either. It's just really not my bag, and I've been kind of wondering why. I've been curious about it, and I just think it's kind of the delayed gratification, I think, thing that's really not my deal. I mean, I know some people would probably really enjoy building up their army. I mean, there is a point. I mean, the first thing you do. I mean, let me just explain exactly what this was.
Sure.
Because it was kind of limited. I mean, it's Halo style StarCraft. So you have to you have to build your army, and you can build, you know, infantry units of various types. You can build air units, ground units, kind of defensive units to defend your bases. And the goal, the way this particular thing was set up was you were playing death matches, 2 versus 2. So you and one other randomly matched person would play 2 other randomly matched people. And you choose a commander, very kind of Advanced Wars style, where there was only two commanders in this particular one that you could choose from, one that was Covenant and one that was UNSC. So they have different commander attacks, kind of thing. So special, you know, kind of attacks or healing, you know, powers that they could use at a certain point in the match when certain criteria was met. So these two versus two matches, they're interesting because, of course, the way you start out is you're kind of scrambling to amass an army, which is always kind of weird for me because you kind of start off sort of just building, you know, and you never know what the other people are doing, you know. And it's interesting from the standpoint of people approach things differently. Some people, they kind of amass a small strike force and start to harass you early. Some people prefer to build a massive army of air power or a massive army of ground power with, you know, the tank variations that they have. So you never kind of really know what you're going to get. So you just sort of, you know, you play your strategy out and kind of see how it works. Usually what I would do is, you know, you start off with a singular base, and then you can kind of, you know, in a couple of ground units, and you kind of send the ground units over there, and you can collect resources that are scattered around the map, and you can kind of capture nodes. Like, before you start actually going after enemy bases, you can kind of capture nodes that improve your supplies or your kind of there's like electrical, there's two resources, I don't know exactly what they're called. Like, there's ones that are just normal kind of resources, and then there's like sort of electrical resources, and anything that you build requires some combo of these resources, right? So you have to kind of, that's the whole resource management gig that you have to kind of deal with. So you kind of have the choice early on of, you know, do you amass resources or do you amass an army? Of course, the more resources you amass, the better vehicles and stuff that you can build, the more that you can upgrade your bases, which then allow you to create better infantry units and stuff like that. So, yeah. So the 2-on-2, not bad. You know, it's usually I would be like, I'd prefer to kind of just play through at my own pace. But it was interesting because you get to see, especially with me, where I don't really know how to play this stuff very well. So it was interesting to me to see how other people play it that are presumably more experienced.
Right.
You could tell there were some people where I would get matched with somebody and they would pretty much just go through and just like destroy everything. Like, I might as well have not even been there. I'm sitting here like, doo-dee-doo, I'm going to, like, you know, make some tanks. And they're, like, already, like, taking over half the map, destroying other people's bases and stuff like that. It was pretty obvious that they knew exactly what they were doing and exactly what they wanted to do. Overall, I mean, it was entertaining. I don't know if I'm going to get it. I don't know. I would like to play through kind of a campaign. It's been interesting, I'll say that. I mean, even stuff like Advanced Wars is, you know, I kind of lose interest in it.
Fair enough.
But I don't know. But I mean, it's the same kind of deal. So I mean, it's good. The game looks really good. Playing with the controller is okay. I feel like.
Does it feel like if you played somebody with a mouse and keyboard, you'd be at a huge disadvantage?
I don't think you'd be at a huge disadvantage, but I think things would be snappier. I think definitely you'd be able to just kind of navigate the map a lot quicker and move stuff around. I don't know. Maybe in the final game, you'll be able to, like kind of move around more quickly, or maybe adjust to how quickly you can pan around the board. But it was a little bit slow. So, but I mean, it's not bad at all. I think they're going to be adding mouse support. Like, I know the Xbox One will eventually get keyboard and mouse support, so that'll probably be mitigated at some point in the future.
I'm kind of surprised it doesn't have it already, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't know why. I mean, it's literally running Windows 10, so...
It's got USB ports all over it, so just do this.
Yep. So, yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it. Am I going to get it? Probably. I might hold off a while, but it's an interesting diversion, I could say. I'd like to see how the campaign is. That'd be kind of interesting, since I am kind of interested in, you know, Halo lore and stuff, since they fleshed out a lot since way back in the day when it was just a bunch of Space Marines running around doing stupid shit. So
yes, but it sure was.
Yeah,
a bunch of Space Marines getting stuck on a rock trying to drive a Warthog.
Yeah, pretty much. So
they should make that part of the lore. They really should.
So yeah, it's pretty cool.
Cool.
So we'll see later on if it's something I actually really dig into.
Cool. I'm looking forward to hearing your thoughts on it. Mm-hmm. Guillaume.
Yes.
What's up, Guillaume?
Yeah, well, when we did our retroactive on Rondo of Blood, I was enjoying the game. Like, I did not finish it, but I enjoyed playing it. And it kind of inspired me to pick up Order of Ecclesia again, a game that I've owned since it came out. It was a Castlevania game for the DS, the third and final one. And it's the only one that I bought that I hadn't finished. So I was like, well, might as well start over. When did this come out? 2008. Fuck me. Anyway. So yeah.
The hottest bangers.
Yeah, eight years ago, just...
It's still old. It might be old, but it's still young enough that I spoke about it on our...
It's true.
Jesus. I got a new copy in there. Go to the back end of 2008, it's there somewhere, me talking about this game when it was new.
Anyway.
So I was all primed to, like, play this and really, like, blow through it. Like, I don't know, like, I imagine myself just, like, finishing it really quickly and maybe even, you know, trying Harmony of Dissonance, which I never finished either, on the Wii U Virtual Console, and then, you know, like, crossing my fingers for Portrait of Ruin, which is another one that I kind of skipped. But I'm not even sure if I'm going to finish it now. Order of Ecclesia is a freaking hard game.
Yes.
And I guess that's the reason why I just... I never finished it back in the day. But so it's a tough game, but also I think I made things harder back then than I needed to for myself. Because if I look at my old save file, so the game had this thing where, yes, like the enemies dealt a lot more damage than usual. You dealt less damage, maybe, I'm not sure. Like the enemies can take a beating. They're really hard to kill, and the bosses even more so. It's just like this long, long war of attrition unless you level up, and level up takes a lot of time. But I think that back then I wanted to prove to myself that I didn't need to level up and things like that. And when you kill bosses without getting hit once, you get this kind of medal for having done that.
it's like what they do with Rondo. We talked about the one up thing,
right?
Didn't we?
Exactly. Except that in Rondo, you know, like maybe like I don't know 8-10 hits of the whip maximum or something like that, yes. And they're done. But in this case, it's more like there's like three or four phases, and you have to avoid like I know, 4 different types of attacks, and you have to hit them the whole time.
You're talking about pretty intricate boss design. For me, this was something that was really refreshing about the game, especially in the early stages, because a lot of the time in those Igavania games, the early bosses are just kind of, unless somehow you had got there, we'd really underleveled. You could just kind of stand there and dish out punishment and probably win. Even if you were avoiding the attacks, they weren't terribly complex. These bosses, from what I recall of it, and it's been some time since I played it, they have real design in them. The attack patterns and all that kind of stuff. Really,
they're puzzle bosses, effectively.
Yeah, they show some real thought, and they require both, you know, sort of effective strategy and just the reflexes to get it.
Yeah, and they're very impressive, you know, but. I think maybe I was aiming a little bit too high when I was playing this, because I see that I have the medals for 1, 2, Arthro medal, Skeleton, Brachyura, Manheater, 11 medals, 11 bosses, where I probably, like, just like every time that I would get hit once, I would hit reset and I would start over, you know? Aww. And I I wonder why I got burnt out in this game.
That is odd. Yeah, as a replay, maybe. You know, I think, isn't there, like, with the latter Igavania games, don't they do, like, replays where it's got, like, level caps and stuff, you know, like, to kind of make the game, you know, if you want to sort of try out the challenge of the game where it can't be sort of tilted in your favor by being over.
Yeah, and I never really went for those. But I think that I was playing this at the same time, maybe, or soon after I was playing games like SSX3 and F-Zero GX, where I would do restart all, you know, over and over again, trying to perfect. I was in this phase in my gaming career.
You really should have got into Rhythm Heaven.
God!
You would have loved the GBA one for just trying to, you know, perfect that.
Be perfect all the time.
You would have scratched that itch very nicely, I think.
Yeah. But unfortunately, I was not into that type of game back then. I didn't import Rhythm Tengoku or anything like that. I was played it safe. I was playing Igavania games, and anyway, I got burnt out in this one. I can see, like, my save file is right before a boss, and yeah, clearly I never beat it, and I don't know if I even attempted to beat it without getting hit, but I did now. I went back to that save file, and I could not beat that boss. My Castlevania skills have atrophied. Clearly.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you know, that kind of game as well, I don't know whether it's, obviously it's kind of got these RPG elements and stuff, but it still doesn't seem like a kind of game I would want to come into the middle of cold.
I just tried it just to see if I could, and I can't. I got my answer. I got my answer. But, so I started over, and I don't know, like, I got frustrated. I think I get frustrated by games way faster than I did back then. And even just the fact that I was going through this area, this forest, and I got killed after exploring a lot and not finding a save room. And so, like, all this, you know, lots and lots of exploration work undone, having to go back to the previous save file and that, like, I was almost ready to quit, but then, like, right before recording, I started the file again. I actually made back that progress and more, and found a save file, a save room. So, nice. I don't know, like, how do you say that? My willingness to go through this.
Willpower?
My willpower. Yeah, I don't know. Like, it's going up and down right now. So I don't even know if I'm going to finish it, but, I'm going at a good pace through it, I guess, like 30% into the game. I know that to get the actual real ending, you have to accomplish these kind of side quests for the villagers in this village. And these side quests might be like, find me these ingredients for a potion, or it might be take a picture of this rare monster that you're going to have to find in one of the dozen of levels that are in this game. If I do finish the game, I'm probably going to go to an FAQ to do most of that stuff.
I forget now exactly, you know, sort of what the bad ending's like, you know, sort of how unsatisfactory that is. But, because I don't know whether you even see the castle without
Right. Sort
of yeah.
Yeah. I know that on my previous save file, I did make it to the castle. So, yeah, go me from 2008.
Nice.
I forget. It has been a while. But my recollection of it is that, you know, those areas outside the castle that make up, you know, the first half of the game, really. You know, you've got a sort of isolated level thing. You know, it's more of a linear type of thing, although you get there is exploration involved. But it doesn't really capitalize on the possibilities that gives you in a level design sense.
No.
Like, you know, this is something you wouldn't necessarily have to trudge past to get to another place in the castle if it was, you know, some component of that interconnected kind of world, you know, that they sort of were cribbing from in Metroid. You know, so you don't necessarily have to make it sort of for quick retraversal. You could just think about making it a kind of deliberate platform challenge, more, you know, perhaps in the mold of something like Rondo that we talked about with the retroactive. It does not do that. It is corridors of enemies to kill, with who are tougher than they typically were in these sorts of games. So, yeah, I always felt like the level design did not really sort of support the structural change that they made there.
And it's funny because you go back to the reviews back then. I didn't go look. Oh, I should go look at the Nintendo World Report one. But I went to Shane Bettenhausen reviewed it for 1UP and gave it an A-. IGN gave it 9 out of 10. Matt Bozon, and it's just I'm reading this and I'm like, what are you guys on? Because it's just like, oh, it's a return to form for Castlevania. Like, it's in some ways it's going back to the series roots, and other ways it pushes forward. And Matt Bozon almost seems to be reviewing the hype, you know? Like,
I don't know. You know what they were looking at. So I enjoyed the game a lot. I enjoyed the challenge. I think the way the bosses were was a pretty sizable improvement over some of the Igavania games. But like I say, it just disappointed. It seemed to me like they kind of missed the point about like what if it was an attempt to have some more kind of linear self-contained stages, because that's something that had been in Castlevania before. It kind of missed the point about why I, at least, like what I liked in those stages, because they still are very much in the paradigm, level design wise, of a symphony of Portrait of Ruin, for that matter, having played that in the years hence, where it's just, you know, really quite basic, almost brawler-esque, you know, not a considered, you know, layout of platform challenges and all that kind of stuff.
No, they're basically mini castles. All of them, like mini, I don't know, they're like an area in Super Metroid.
Yeah,
here's Brinstar.
They don't really show the kind of hallmarks
mini-vanias.
Of, okay, this is a separate thing and we're going to use a different philosophy to design it. It just kind of feels like a chunk carved out.
By the way, Zach Miller reviewed this and he gave it a 9. And he said, quote unquote, all in all, Order of Ecclesia is one of the best Castlevania games ever produced.
I kind of wonder if... Yeah, I don't know. I kind of wonder if everyone would stand by those opinions now, because
Shane
Bettenhausen, like, he talks of stuff that I'm not sure exists, you know? Like, he's Ecclesia's innovative glyph system, blah, blah, blah.
I do
you
remember
have to
liking,
experiment
I do
combos.
Remember liking the glyph system quite a lot.
I don't understand.
That's
like,
Shane Bettenhausen of 8 years ago?
Yeah, no, but like the review talks of combos.
Show
and
him.
You really have to like experiment with the different glyphs to get the best, you know, kind of to create combos. But all it is you press X and Y alternatively to keep dishing damage. Like I haven't found like two different glyphs that actually, I don't know, like there's no upside to taking two different glyphs to a fight. Against a boss, like you're better off equipping two of the weapon that deals the most damage. You know, at best, like you might want to get like a spell and a kind of a, you know, like a hammer or whatever, because the spell you're not going to have to be right in front of boss to use it. But that's about it. That's about the extent of the strategy.
I mean, I can remember enjoying that, you know, but I'd enjoyed some of those things before, like the soul system. in the Sorrow game, so it wasn't like a quantum leap or anything. But I did, my only memory I could say to that is that I did find myself kind of experimenting with different sets of glyphs when I might be struggling against a boss, you know, and that's kind of like, okay, let's try a different approach rather than let's go and kill a bunch of enemies for a while and level up. Like that's the way I kind of approached those things. I was a bit stubborn about trying to just, that was the closest I got to your stubbornness with those, I guess.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't mean to make everyone who loved this game back then defend their opinions.
I liked it a lot. I don't know whether I'd put it over the Sorrow games.
IGN was just like, it fills the shoes, you know, the big shoes of the Symphony of the Night, judgment. You know.
Symphony, which I didn't have any kind of nostalgia for because I didn't play it until like 2009. A lot of the bosses in that are something or nothing. In that sense, Order of Ecclesia kicks the shit out of it. But in terms of obviously, that type of game was so much more well traveled by that time.
Yeah.
And, I don't know whether the atmosphere reaches that kind of level because it's still, DS could do some really good music, but I don't know, and the music is good, but it's not symphony good.
No.
So it's kind of stronger in some areas and weaker in others. I didn't feel like there was a really kind of, and just the fact that it was, this iteration, the sixth of those games.
God.
It across the Nintendo Portable.
And none of them were Pachinko. What?
Unbelievable.
So they soon missed. Rectified that. They got down to business there.
Flip the lever!
Yep.
And I didn't play all of them back then. I skipped Harmony of Dissonance, the second GBA game. I played Aria of Sorrow, which was, my favorite. And then Dawn of Sorrow, I was starting to feel Castlevania fatigue. Remember thinking, this is not as good as Aria. It's more grindy. It's not as well designed.
Old days where you could have Castlevania fatigue.
Yeah. That's
right.
Well, you wouldn't like Metroid fatigue. Those were the days.
All right. You've got Federation Force coming out. Calm down.
But yeah, and so I remember like skipping Portrait of Ruin because it was not getting that great.
I did exactly the same thing. I skipped Harmony and I skipped that one at the time. I've gone back and played all of them since because guess what? The fatigue went away.
Yeah.
And, I mean, on that note, kind of, I had a similar experience. I've been thinking about maybe going back to Aria Sorrow for the first time in many years after that lost out in the retroactive poll.
I think it would probably be a good idea because Aria is maybe like 12 hours long, I think. Whereas my previous save file where I'm incomplete save file is 13 hours, and that probably doesn't include all the restarting that I've done. So
much like my Fire Emblem Fates hour clock, it's probably about half of what I actually do.
Right. Yeah, so I don't know. I guess I would tell people if you want to revisit the Castlevania kind of the Metroid like Castlevanias, go for the better ones.
For me, the action elements of it are better than in quite a few of those Igavanias.
Yeah,
but the exploration is definitely weaker. The level design, I don't think it's ever really been a strength of those games if you compare them to the Metroid games that they're cribbing off. But the Order of Ecclesia is even perhaps less so about the level design.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah. So I would love to see these hit the Wii U Virtual Console. Konami, people can give you money, which I know is your unabiding
speaking
joy.
Speaking of the Wii U Virtual Console, James, I mean, there are three Pokemon Mystery Dungeon games all at once. I'm sure you are in jubilant mood.
Let's move on! Because it's time for a break before this turns into an ugly scene. And after we get back, it's time for your listener mail. Bye. It's Now Playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have a preview, Sonic Boom, Fire and Ice, on 3DS by Brian Rose. Brian lays it out there right from the start, saying that this game isn't, quote, outright terrible. He seems to know how low a bar we all set for the Sonic games, and gives us his thoughts after getting some hands-on playtime at E3. Rest assured, wash those hands since, likely many times, to get the Sonic stink off of them. I hope he, like, wore gloves?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how experienced he is with Sonic games.
Have you been experienced?
Yeah.
I've got so many jokes I want to make, but I just can't make them. I'm just going to move on. We also have a review, Tokyo Mirage Sessions Sharp FE by Don Koopman / Donald Terrio. Double dose of Don as Herr Koopster and Therio take their shot at reviewing the newest weird super Japanese game that people think is great. Shin Megami Tensei and Fire Emblem fans, take note. You probably don't want to miss this one.
That's what I hear on the Twitters. It's, you know, whatever.
Anime is happening anime all the time.
Actually, and Donald actually, he does say that in his review. He says that anime is happening.
He uses the anime is happening phrase?
Yep.
We're going to have to push anime is happening.
Yep. All right, and we have a review of Zero Time Dilemma for 3DS by Donald Terrio. I don't know. Terrio sounds like so. Terrio just sounds.
I'm gonna go Terrio.
Okay.
It's got more oomph to it.
Yeah. Sounds more French.
This is all staying in, by the way.
the other Don. That's what I call him. Because you know Don Koopman is the Don. Right?
That's right. He is the Don.
Yeah. I mean.
He is the survivor.
Yeah.
The eShop survivor. The Don.
Yep.
Don Koopman.
The other Don takes a run at this puzzle game and comes away with the opinion that Zero Time might describe the amount of time you'll have left after trying to figure out its more obscure puzzles. Find out if you need to keep the FAQ handy in his review. Handy, you totally do.
Poor Donald, there was no FAQ when he played this game.
Yeah, I feel
welcome to the world of review copies.
Yeah. All right, and speaking of reviews, we have a review of Mario and Sonic. Not the preview, a review now to just finish the entire journey. We have a review of Mario and Sonic at the Rio 2016 Olympic Games for Wii U by Don Koopman. What's an Olympic Games without Mario and Sonic? I don't know, and thankfully we can put off answering that terrifying question for 4 more years as Don reviews their newest title. However, how are Mario and Sonic with Zika and sewage-filled ocean water? We're about to find out.
I was going to make the over-under on 40 words to a Zika reference, and I think you pushed. So,
I did.
Congratulations.
I was thinking I might take the high road, but meh. Nah.
I mean, you could have talked about...
The thing is, I didn't even mention corruption. You have to give me some credit. I mean, I did, but I'm just saying in the body of the...
You could also throw in their references about how the government doesn't have any money to fund local services during the Olympics. You could have thrown in the rampant crime that's gripping the country. You could have thrown out about a presidential recall vote, but no, you just went straight... You just went straight to giving babies birth defects. Thanks, John. That's the quality you can expect on Radio Free Nintendo.
Hey, Zika happens. All right.
Is this the new horrible variant of anime is happening?
That's Zika is happening.
I don't even have a throw to the website address. Like, there's nothing for me that's safe to touch here.
Yeah, email Zika at NintendoWorldReport.com.
He gave you the address. Go there for more content. Bye, everybody. And we're back with the first listener mail segment since E3 2016. You could send us your email to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Or you can use a little form. It's in the show notes. It's always there. You should send us your email because we love getting emails. Like these emails. Austin writes, "Well, I never thought I'd hear about a Trinitron or Wega on a modern gaming podcast. I understand your plight, though, Guillaume. I do all of my gaming on a widescreen HD 1080i Sony CRT from, like, 2004. Wonderful picture for modern or old-school games, but it's a little heavy at 191 pounds.
Yeah, you don't want those things to fall over on a child.
1080i is such a crazy thing to even think about. That was a thing that existed.
Yep.
Because of TVs like this. Anyway, here's a little question. How much pre-release information do you like to eat for a game that you already know you're going to buy? I presume Zelda Into the Wild is a sure purchase for all of you.
God, damn.
I was gonna fix it, but like I like that there's all these like potential other names for this game because Breath of the Wild is such a crazy title.
It's gonna be like a drinking game, isn't it? And like you have to do bonus shots if it's a fresh incorrect name that no one's used.
That's
yet.
Into the Wild is a good one. So
if we get to The Legend of Zelda When Nature Calls, I quit. Let's just put it that way.
What's sad is like people are gonna start sending us emails with just deliberately incorrect names now. Anyway,
Into the Wild does mean I think Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam would be doing the soundtrack if I remember correctly.
Yeah, the Zelda's gonna rock. Anyway, so looking at all the information about it is really just for fun. Let me take a step back, because we're already going to buy it. Does it take some of the fun out of the game when you finally play it? Having already seen all this stuff, obviously. But our long, like, sidebar about Eddie Vedder and his Zelda soundtrack kind of took us out of the email for a minute there. His question, in a nutshell, is if you know you're going to buy the game, do you go into an information blackout, or do you just keep watching it, and does that potentially hurt your enjoyment of the game?
I generally black out. Generally. I mean, so we still are talking about video games, right? And not alcohol. Okay. All right. So, yeah, I mean, if I know I'm going to buy something, I do not sit there and pore over game footage and every single thing. I'm like, okay, I'm going to maybe if there's a particular part of the game I'm curious about, I might check that out. Or if there's a video about something that I don't really completely grasp, I'll check it out. But in general, like, I'm pretty much avoiding anything on Monster Hunter Cross. Or Monster Hunter Generations. I'm avoiding everything.
You avoided the. I thought for a minute you'd avoided the localized title.
Trying. Even though today I will say I did watch the video about the Strider Hiryu armor that they're bringing to the game. And I'm just like, oh, Capcom. You're so Capcom-y.
It makes me crazy that they're doing this stuff. Yeah. So does that mean that you are like, are you going information blackout on the Legend of Zelda Wild Things too, or are you still
the Legend of Zelda Where the Wild Things Are? I watched a lot of the videos just because I didn't really know. I was curious to see what they were going to do with it, and I kind of
it was like the first time we really saw anything substantial, wasn't it? So that I think you most of the time I'm going to at least check that out.
Yeah,
Like when you did the first substantial stuff, but whether to take it much further, I don't know. It tends to be case by case basis. There's no blanket policy.
The Shrine of Trials video for me, that was a bit much because I'm like, I don't really need to see these puzzles. I'd like this to actually be a surprise when I finally get to it.
Granted, it was 2 out of 100 plus, so it's not so bad. But yeah, to your point, it's like, well. Yeah, I don't necessarily need to see all of these. I watched it because I wanted to understand what the shrines were, and I figured when I play this game almost a year from now, I'll probably have forgotten the solution to these puzzles. And ultimately, the puzzles in those are pretty straightforward. But yeah, I mean, I haven't watched all 72 hours of Zelda streaming Nintendo did. I watched Anuma's playthrough, which is the last thing I watched, which it's kind of fascinating to see him play that game. Because like this is the product of his brain in a lot of ways. So it's like, okay, what does he do with this toolbox they've given him? But yeah, I get where you're at. Like, I don't go information blackout in general. For story stuff, I will. But this game seems like a lot of the joy is going to come from like, hey, can I do this? Oh shit, I can do this.
Yeah. And also, I mean, it seems like they went to some effort to make the demo, non-story spoilerish, to the point that maybe just not having any NPCs or any of that, So yeah, they've kind of accommodated people that want to avoid that kind of element while wanting to see, as I said, just what is the game, to really get the sense of the sort of game it's going to be. But at that point, I don't particularly feel the need to get into minutia. Whereas, I don't know, with something like Smash Brothers, where they're quite keen to deal out minutia, all along the way. Like, I'm fine with that, I mean, maybe there'd be something to be said for just coming into it and like, oh, I can't believe this item's in it and this character's in it and all that. It's just, I don't know, something like Smash Brothers, obviously it's not a narrative-driven experience, all that. I get there could be some you know, joy in seeing like levels and things you know, unlock for the first time while playing the game, but it's kind of the same experience just finding out they exist pre-release as well.
Right.
You know, yeah, something like Smash Brothers, I'm kind of content to go, you know, to seek out, you know, a lot of information, consume the information they put out there. Whereas, yeah, you know, a lot of games, I'm kind of like, yep, I'm buying it. That's enough. You know, I don't need, I don't need to. Or like, you know, in the case of, say, for instance, the Mario Kart 8 DLC, I mean, I'd literally already bought the second bit. So I may as well not.
That's true.
I may as well not really gorge on media about it because it's already done.
Yeah, plus, personally, I don't really read previews. I never really have. And,
you can read more previews at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Yeah, no, well, you know, I'm just, telling it like it is. I never really hype myself up for games, like, far in advance. And the fact is, we don't even have the solid release date for Zelda still. So, what's the point, you know, for a game that's, pretty much like a year, away? Why would I try to get my hands on every little bit of info when every little bit of info was shown last week? And they're probably turning the tap off. Like, there's not going to be more info coming out. So what am I going to be reading? Like, I'm going to be watching the same footage of the same demo over and over again. Like, I'm going to read these think pieces or, like, people, you know, like their fan fiction about what they think the story is going to be, where in the timeline the game falls. Like, yeah. What's the point?
We can never have
enough. Well, I don't think there's any point to it, but speculation can be fun. I think that's mainly what people do that for, is to have fun with it and then come back when, you know, the facts come out and see how the speculation matches up and all that. That's all it is.
Yeah, sure. Like, I'm not against people having their fun. I'm just saying, like, personally, I don't.
Guillaume, no fun.
Yeah, no fun allowed. No, but, like, I prefer to get hyped for games that I'm about to get my hands on, you know, like, I've been pre-ordering games a lot because I can get deals through that, up here in Canada. But, other than that, like, I would never pre-order a game just because I'm purely hyped for it, right? Like, even, I've got a pre-order for, Mirage, Tokyo Mirage Sessions Sharp FE, but I don't think I was really hyped for it until the reviews came out. And, not any reviews. Like, I've read some of the reviews that were really high scoring, and I thought, well, this is just like, the guy is just listing, like, the Fire Emblem characters that appear, and that doesn't mean anything to me, and I'm not really, you know, I'm not really into this. But then the Polygon review is actually really well written and kind of really, I don't know, like, kind of sold me on the flow of the game. Like, told me, okay, this is something that I could really get into, especially after playing Seventh Dragon and really enjoying the combat in that. Like, yeah. So like, basically, the game went, Tokyo Mirage Sessions went from, I guess I'm going to play this to, oh my God, I got to get it. But that process happened like a week before it comes out.
Yeah. And usually that for me is the key spots is, you know, kind of what we've had with Breath of the Wild, where it's like, okay, this is the general sort of thrust of the game, what it looks like, you know, kind of the real surface view kind of the game. And then the in-depth stuff at the end, when you're talking about reviews or maybe very in-depth hands-on impressions that might be shortly before the game comes out, something like that. Those are the bits I generally pay attention to. It's only, you know, and then with it's only sort of really odd cases where it occupies this middle ground where it's like, well, there's enough in this game that has me intrigued about it, that I, you know, want to seek out information about it, but on the other hand, it's not enough that it's some sort of slam dunk. I mean, it's rarely about purely getting hyped for me. That would probably just be a Smash Brothers thing, to be honest. It's about the only game that can do that to me. But, you know, it's more a sort of curiosity thing. Right. You know, it might not be. Sometimes it's for games that you don't have great confidence that they're going to be all that good. I mean, you know, I mean, one of the games that I was interested in quite a lot, even though, you know, I wasn't at all confident I would buy it or what I would make of it if I did was the Castlevania Lords of Shadow for 3DS. It was kind of like, you know, because, you know, I played the PS3 game, I played a lot of Castlevania, you know, and then it's like, okay, we're kind of taking the PS3 game into 2D and kind of gonna say it's more like the old Castlevanias, all this. It was just like, you know, I wasn't all that confident in that game. And that was just kind of the perfect store for me to be like, okay, well, you know, every kind of time there was some experience with that game that somebody had, I was kind of eager to see, you know, what they had to say about it. You know, especially because it might have a bearing on like the future of Castlevania games on Nintendo platforms, which
yeah, well,
has become fairly
little did you know,
fairly apparent. Well, I suspected, and it certainly, you know, has gone the bad way. You know, the future is very bleak on that front since then. But you know, so yeah, that is a rare case. There's a rare intersection of factors there, you know, sort of series that you're interested in, but not so, you know, but without the kind of, you know, some kind of question over exactly what kind of experience is going to be, and you know, you're not altogether confident in its quality level, but it's not as if you're dismissing it out of hand. It's got to be a really perfect storm of things for me to very, very closely follow things like that.
Sure. Like, I went on a pretty hard blackout for Xenoblade Chronicles X, but for, you know, for Legend of Zelda Wild Hogs, I'm busy looking at a lot of video of the game because I'm like, okay, what can this physics engine do? And you're not going to get that from the Nintendo playthroughs, but like people who shot video of their own playthroughs from the show floor, it's like, all right, Link's skating down the hill on his shield, and then he runs into a bomb, which he detonates at the exact moment he goes over it. What happens? Like, what is, like, I'm curious more about the robustness of the physics engine and the ways you can just dick around with it. I had a lot of the same things with Mario Maker before it came out. We're like, okay, how big of an asshole can I be in this game? But in that case, they went super radio silent on the game until that Nintendo World Championships, and I realized, oh, I can be the history's greatest asshole in this game. Perfect. This is what I want. So, like, I've watched a lot of media for this game just to figure out, like, how robust is the do-whatever-you-want-ness here? Because I'm curious, like, what kind of crazy thing can I wire up, like, Rube Goldberg video game experience can I give myself with this game? And I think that's kind of where that's, I'm not so much interested in seeing like story content or like, you know, gameplay beats. Just like, I want to see what the game engine does when I do something stupid. And there have been a gratifying number of videos of people going like, hey, let's check out this stupid thing I tried. Here's it in like animated image form, which is, you know, that's what the internet is giving us now. And that's like those little beats of moment, like one of the Guardians shooting a laser at Link, and you see the laser like gleam in the distance as his eye charges up, and then of course it's a laser, so it's instantly there, and all of a sudden you see that essentially like a little BMO explode because the person playing the game put up a mirror shield and shot it back at him, and that was all instantaneous. So like all you see in the image is flash explosion, and that's really cool, and like that in its own way works to sort of get hype. But it doesn't really give you much of the game. It's just this one little experience where you say, like, oh, they get it. That's cool.
Yeah, it's the game's potential that you see.
Right.
Yep.
But you're not, I'm not following it super closely. But next email, Greg.
So Adrian writes, hi guys, I forgot to include this in a previous email, but it's a hypothetical scenario for all of you to consider. The scenario is, for reaching 500 episodes, the RFN crew is awarded an honorary doctorate for contributions to the field of media/journalism. You each have to give a short speech for the occasion about your personal journey and that of the show in front of a sizable audience. Break a leg.
I mean, I might do that actually to get out of doing it.
Yeah, that's an option.
To those assembled here, I apologize that my receiving of this degree has completely invalidated the work that you did because I have been given it for doing what arguably is a terrible mistake. And at the same time, I have managed to besmirch the institution that would give it to you. So I have made your degree both less meaningful and less valuable. And on that, it is consistent with all the work that I have done over the last 10 years. thank you for your time.
I mean,
and then I might just drop pants and get off the stage at that point. Just say fuck it, I'm out.
I mean, mine would be pretty simple. Mine would be, Your Honor, I don't know these men and have never seen them before in my life.
That's not what a doctorate is.
Well, it's in a sizable audience. I mean, you know,
he didn't mean 12 of your peers.
I think that by episode 500, John has gone senile, basically. Doesn't know where he's going.
Episode 5.
You don't have a whole lot of time left. I'm sorry, John.
Yep.
Oh, damn.
Well, that got darker than I expected.
I think, I would say something along the lines of, an evil man once said that if you're good at something, never do it for free. And we have tried to defy that with all our might for 500 episodes. But unfortunately, the basic premise kind of invalidates that. But never mind. Try the veal. Whatever. I don't know how you sign up for that.
At one point, we may be good at this, at which point we will start charging for it. For the time being, you're free to suffer along with the rest of us.
Yeah, I don't know. I would just be, temper your expectations. You know, I'm sure you're full of ambition and you want to change the world and you want to, I don't know, really do a good job and just like tone it down a little bit. You're going to ruin it for the rest of us.
Lower your expectations.
My favorite phrase other than it won't get better.
This is as good as it's going to get. Drop mic.
That's right. You are fresh, idyllic, and you are ending your college career, which means the bubble that your parents have kept you in is fucking over.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to real life.
Unless
assholes.
Your parents are rich and well connected,
you'll stay inside the bubble. Exactly. You'll stay inside the bubble for the rest of your life.
Oh. This got dark.
Quickly.
If you're a university looking to give somebody an honorary doctorate, I will take it in astrophysics, any kind of medical fields, or the law. I'm not really interested in journalists, a doctorate in journalism. I feel like that's probably, you know,
I think the only school that would consider giving us honorary doctorates would be like in community or something. I can't remember the name of that institution, but yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's some mail order places. I could get us all doctorates by the end of the show. I mean, yeah.
Oh, nice.
I can get them overnight. It will be good. I mean, you may have to print it yourself, but that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, you might as well just become ordained priest as well. Cost you about 20. Oh, I've underestimated you,
I took my holy orders 6 years ago, John. What are you talking about?
Well, this has turned dark.
Next email.
All right, the next email. Brad asks, "Hi, fellas. Love the show. A few questions. Number one. Can you explain the differences between a developer and a publisher? I am a little hazy on this point."
All right, let's do this one. So there's a few terms here. There's developer, there's publisher, there's also the concept of distributor, although that's kind of, with digital distribution, that's kind of dropped off a bit. So developer. Developer made the game. A developer they may not have made the game on their own. There may have been multiple developers involved.
That means writing the code.
Right. Doing the art, potentially doing the music.
Usually they do testing themselves. Not all the time. Sometimes.
Yeah. Sometimes the publisher does testing.
Yep.
Sometimes they both do testing.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, developers, there can be multiple developers on a project. And I would imagine most games at this point probably do have multiple developer companies on a project.
Yeah. Like maybe one company will do the campaign, the other company will do the online portion, stuff like that.
Right. And some may be doing engine work and others are doing actual game content. I mean, it's all over the place.
Yep.
But a developer as a company, as opposed to being an independent developer, which is usually a person or a small collection of people who kind of have a company they own, versus a developer company that is both independent or a developer company that is owned by a publisher. A publisher handles the marketing of a game. They handle the financing of the game's creation. They usually pay the developers. Not always. Sometimes that's stipulated based on sales of the game. But they essentially take ownership of the game for the purposes of retailing it.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, they invest money in the game's development, and as a result, they get to reap the benefits of the game's success.
Yes, and at the same time, you will see them, if they don't like the game's concept, they can also cancel it outright, which is why you will hear about publishers, you know, games not getting greenlit or games being deep into the dev cycle and the publisher decides to can the entire project.
Because it's their, I mean, it's their money.
Yep.
In at risk here. So they, these are your, and it sounds dismissive to say, and there is this kind of weird trend lately of like, oh, publishers don't know shit. They're just businessmen in suits. But, you know, you do, to a certain extent, you need that when you're dealing with these kinds of big financial risks. Because games, I mean, unless you're talking about a small independent game, games cost a lot of money to make.
And market. That's the big thing.
And market.
Because a lot of these smaller game developers, they do not have the money nor the manpower to properly get
or the
marketing out. Exactly. It's just not their forte.
Or the contacts. Yeah. So a publisher may handle the distribution of the game. They may handle the marketing. They may handle, just John pointed out, they may handle the testing. And they may co-work testing. They may also, if there's multiple developers involved, manage that interplay of the different developers involved. They may, you know, if you have a developer who doesn't have access to like maybe some component they need for the game, like a musician, they may arrange that component. They're sort of your producer role, essentially. Mm-hmm. Where you run into some granularity there is development studios that are owned by publishers, which is to say they are a subsidiary of the publisher. So EA has lots. EA, Ubisoft, Activision to some extent have a lot of these studios inside themselves that produce games for them. But in this case, pretty much all the work is being dictated down to them by the publisher. The publisher is saying, hey, it's time for Madden. Go and Madden, Tiburon. Yep. And Tiburon goes and makes a Madden and comes back and says, here is the Madden. And EA goes and sells it. Mm-hmm. Conversely, you may have a situation where there is a publisher or a developer who is making a game. And they have either completed the game, they have proof of concept for the game, or they may just have, you know, a pitch. And they shop it around to various publishers until they find the one whose deal they like to work with. You know, someone who say, you know, the right split of money versus resources versus the end result based on the game's success. IP ownership, you know, what things the publisher can provide in terms of marketing, in terms of experience, in terms of like stuff like getting through lot check. You know, they find a partner they want to make the deal with, and then the publisher doesn't own the company making the game, but they own the rights to sell the game when it is completed.
Yeah, and the IP too. That was important. You touched on that, but that's important too. Usually the publisher owns the IP. Which means that they can if they don't like the work that this one dev house is doing, they can dump them and get somebody else to make the game for them.
Right.
Which happens.
And with an independent one, that one is usually one of the more contentious negotiating points. Mm-hmm. But then you have this third kind of thing, and you don't see it a whole lot. It used to happen a lot more. We have the distributor. And in this case, you have a publisher who is usually kind of a larger entity. So Rock Band is a good example. The developer of Rock Band was Harmonix. MTV Games, which is an entity that was created effectively to sell Rock Band, was the publisher. So they financed the game. They handled the marketing. They handled essentially everything except for manufacturing and retailing, getting the game to retailers. And of course, with that game, there was extra lift for retailing that game because you had to produce your fucking plastic instruments. Mm-hmm. And you had to put your boxes together and just ship all this stuff. So in that case, they had a company called the distributor. And for that series, it was EA. EA has the logistics chain to manufacture this stuff, to get this stuff to market, and essentially to, you know, figure out where it needs to go, figure out how many units need to be shipped to different places, make sure that the Chinese factory where they're producing the stupid drum kits has the right kinds of plastic in play. Like they are responsible for essentially getting the game onto shelves. And in that case, they take a cut of some description. And usually they strike a deal with the publisher who originally struck a deal with the developer. You don't see that a lot because of the role of digital games now and the fact that most games are pressed to disc, so it doesn't really require as much lift. You'll also see it sometimes when you have a small publisher. I think Exeed used to use Konami a lot. And they don't want to go through the process of negotiating a disc manufacturing contract with Nintendo, so they'll just use Konami's, and Konami will take a cut, and Konami put the game on the store shelves, and that would be the way they'd handle it. Because of the prevalence of like, well, we'll just make it digital only, I don't care. That has allowed publishers to kind of cut out that larger party who's taking on some of the logistical work and keep more of that money in-house. But conversely, that's allowed developers to also become publishers. So you have something like Yacht Club Games, which is not a big company, who has published a fairly substantial game, and as a result is directly corresponding with platform holders. So in the West, they have deals with all the platform holders for various pieces of exclusivity. In Japan, they've actually sold the publishing rights to Nintendo, and so Nintendo published Shovel Knight in Japan, which means if you want to play Shovel Knight in Japan, guess what? Go get your Wii U or 3DS out. But it's fairly straightforward, but at the same time, all the weird intricacies of all these different deals make it way more complicated. And at a high level, it's really easy to explain, but every game has a story. And sometimes talking to developers and publishers, you get to hear some shit. And so some of it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, contentious.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, John, you worked. I mean, I don't know how much you want to say, but you've worked in the industry.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I didn't really work too much on directly on the game development side, but right. I mean, certainly
you've seen the machine.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I've seen it inside the machine, and I mean, typically the way it works is you know a bunch of devs, they have a game concept and they work on it and they'll pitch it. Like that's kind of an official process, and you kind of go through several steps. You have a very basic concept for a game, probably nothing mocked out code wise. You know, you'll throw that up the chain. The publisher will say, okay, sounds cool. Okay, go ahead and start coding and give us something. And then, you know, you'll come back with a very, very basic proof of concept. They'll look at it, give you the thumbs up or thumbs down. If they like it, they'll move on to prototyping and, you know, they kind of get more and more advanced. And at any point, at any time, if the publisher does not like what you give them, it's very stressful. Because a lot of times they're working towards this, like some sort of prototype or a more right. polished prototype. Vertical slices is what you'll hear that term. And that's, you know, that is a version of the game, a very early version of the game that includes all of the major chunks of gameplay in like one kind of like, you know, code drop kind of thing.
Right.
So there's like a lot, it's very high pressure because at any point, sometimes you're dealing with, if the publisher decides to can the entire project, that's everybody's jobs are gone. You know, that's what you'll see sometimes. You'll see sometimes, you know, devs will just close down because they were they were looking to get funding for their game and they didn't get the funding that they wanted. So they gotta
leverage the house.
Yep. So they gotta close. So right. You'll see that. And
conversely, the other way that devs and publishers get work, you have something like High Voltage. Mm-hmm. Which is for the most part a port house.
Yep.
So they just say like Bluepoint is another example. They just say like, hey, we're available for hire to make versions of your game, and they're not owned by the publishers who make the game. They don't own the IPs. They're basically being brought in as mercenaries to say like, make the Wii version of this game. Mm-hmm. And if it's High Voltage, they're going to do a bad job. But that friggin' X-Men game. But It's you know, it's just tiers of business ultimately, and it's difficult to understand where that's going to go because as AAA games become increasingly complicated, you need more and more developers.
Yep.
And you can't produce, you know, for everything that I make jokes about Assassin's Creed, you can't produce that outside of what is the equivalent of the movie studio system. Mm-hmm. Like that requires so much investment and so many resources that you have to be a big multinational to even make that game happen.
Yeah, and happen in one territory. I mean, making it happen, you know, having it globalized and having that game playable and working, like, in every territory around the world, like, that takes an army. That's why when you see these game credits, they go on for 15, 20 minutes, because
right.
There's literally hundreds of people involved in the creation of the game, you know.
Yeah. Here's your Ubisoft Shanghai credits.
Yeah, exactly. Translating it, marketing it. I mean, it's just a huge. That's why you need these. You need publishers to just have these massive marketing infrastructures and all these kind of platforms that you need to actually get this stuff out to the entire world.
Because right now, and I'm using that one as an example because I know where Ubisoft has all their studios. There is not a moment of the day where somebody's not working on the next Assassin's Creed game because they essentially have, much like the old British Empire, the sun never sets on fucking Ubisoft, and they've got. They've got development studios cranking around the clock to make that game happen. Mm-hmm. And for a game that size on that tight of a schedule, it causes problems, but that's what you've got to do. And, you know, you can't do that without a big publisher, you know, who's able to finance that kind of insane operation.
Yep.
And I mean, that's the role of the publisher ultimately. And it, as smaller games become more easy to self-publish, I think you're going to see the publishers either try to get into by funding those projects so the developers don't have to eat ramen every day and get in on that way, or shifting their resources to these big, huge projects. Because if you can publish the game yourself, that's always going to be preferable. Because
True. Yep.
You get to keep everything. But.
Yep. All right. You want me to read the next one here?
I do.
Okay. All right. His next question is, when I try to envision a Nintendo character movie, I wonder if they'd be better off attempting something that has less history attached. I laughed a ton playing Tomodachi Life because it took everyday experiences and made them awkward and humorous. Plus, such a landscape would allow for tons of cameos. I worry about using an iconic character, as it puts a ton of pressure on every aspect of a film. And if Nintendo were to develop a film in-house, wouldn't they want to start with something that hurts the brand less if it flops?
I don't think they're going to put out a bad movie. I think first and foremost, they are aware that they've got to not screw this up. But, Guillaume, would you watch Tomodachi Life movie?
I'm not sure how does that work? I don't understand it. Like, exactly. You can't put your friends in the movie. Like, that's...
What if you can?
Oh, wow.
Emoji
okay,
movie?
Just
I mean,
my
if
mind.
They can make that, I think they can make Tomodachi Life.
What if you can put them in the game or in the movie?
You're talking wow. crazy, but I like it.
And John, fuck you for even mentioning Emoji movie on this show.
I had to.
No, you didn't.
But anyway, like, I don't think that a studio would ever think that way. Like, let's put the least iconic character we can think of so that we don't damage the brand. That's not really, I don't think that's how decisions in Hollywood are made. Like, they want something, they want to have a hit, right? So they're going to go with Yep. the most recognizable properties, and hopefully they're going to find people who won't screw it up.
Gotta
so.
Get Will Smith. That's all I ask.
For Pixels too, you gotta get Will Smith.
You gotta get Will Smith. Mm.
Get me Zack Snyder. Let's really make this kind of this gritty and slow motion Mario movie that we need. Wait, it was already made, except slow motion.
The original Super Mario Brothers movie wasn't gritty enough for you. I like everything but the canary yellow suit. Everything else was perfect.
Yeah, I don't know. It was too many colors, though. I think we can desaturate even more.
Hey, I need more wubs in that soundtrack, please.
God.
There we go. Yes, that says Mario to me.
Yeah, so this is just going to devolve into a snarky movie conversation. I can see that already. Every single movie we've ever hated.
Mario by Zack Snyder.
To some extent, I could see where this kind of line of questioning came from, as maybe some people looked at the Miitomo thing that way, you know, into how they handled having that as their first mobile app, you know, that it wasn't one of the sort of character-driven of their properties and whatnot. But again, you know, it's first of all, that seemed to have a particular remit to drive the My Nintendo adoption. Mm-hmm. Rather than necessarily to be a huge money spinner in itself, whereas I suppose there can be no real sort of ulterior motive with the movie other than just raising awareness of the brand, I guess. But that's not going to be the primary driver with a movie if it's going to have a certain level of production values associated with it. You're going to want it to bring in the revenue to offset that, to make it all worthwhile. I have a hard time thinking that it would be something that isn't very well known, but at the same time, you know, there does seem to be opportunities here. We talk about the amount of films that have considerable budgets that have to be based on some sort of pre-existing IP.
Yeah.
I mean, it feels like already
the fucking Emoji movie.
They've probably already hit the bottom of the barrel, you know, and I don't think Nintendo stuff is there. So it's a case of the sticking point has been Nintendo's willingness to to use them in that way, and recent events have made them willing, and I think they probably will. If I know they've talked about exercising a certain level of control and trying to be really careful about it, and they may be doing as much as they can you know, being as involved in the production as they can to try and exercise that level of control and ensure quality or, you know, some sort of integrity for the representation of the characters and all that. So, man, I don't think if they are using that approach, I think maybe they would believe that they could prevent it from, you know, balls in it up, you know.
Star Fox directed by Roland Emmerich. Done.
Oh God!
Well, it would be sort of returning the favor for the stage in Star yes! Fox 64, wouldn't it? No, I mean, you know, it's just that they would, if they were exercising that level of control, I think they'd have enough self confidence to think that it wasn't going to be a balls up, you know, the compromise the brand. So
Michael,
you know,
Bay presents Metroid Other M.
Fuck you!
So, you know,
send your complaints to RFN at NintendoWorldReport.com.
No, so I think just a bit of self-confidence, you know? I mean, if you're really that scared about it being a disaster and compromising the brand, maybe you just shouldn't do it, you know, at yeah. all.
I think the Daibutsu no Mori movie that they did in 2006, something like that, the Animal Crossing.
Yeah.
It's pretty informative because that's a game that's all about being a self-insert character. And they did create sort of the human character, but they, you know, they sort of went with all these other characters that exist around them and just sort of like created a problem that fits in that universe and then had them solve it. And, you know, I think with something like a Zelda, like there's certainly more risk there than if making an Animal Crossing movie. And I think your budget would have to go higher. I don't think you would.
Tomodachi Life. I don't know. Tomodachi Life is all about either like your Miis being
right.
celebrities, and in that case, do you have celebrities playing themselves, or do you have playing their Miis, or celebrities playing other celebrities' Miis? Like, how does that work?
Maybe like the equivalent of a Lego movie, but just with Tomodachi Life kind of.
Or everyone. Everyone is just playing like Admiral Akbar and Jesus and Hitler, and it's just like. Because
yeah.
that's the Miis that you find in most of the Wiis out there.
So I've got so it. True. I've got it. So celebrity Tomodachi Life. So you have like Stone Zac Efron. He could be in there. You can have
Bow Wow would be in there for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You can have Greg, what was your Mario Kart friend?
No, oh, BJ. Yeah. Oh my God. It's an 8 years old reference.
It is,
Mario
yeah.
Kart Wii came out. Playing online.
You know the podcast has been around too long when.
Playing online, this me appears that I described as a flesh-colored whistle-looking thing. And its name was BJ. And James remembers this, even though it didn't happen to him.
Wow.
Well, to be fair, I would go watch Tomodachi Life starring BJ.
Flesh-colored whistle.
That's what it looked like. That's what they made it look
Mommy,
like.
Mommy, what's that flesh-colored whistle?
Oh, God. Wow.
I swear you didn't find this as fucking funny 8 years ago. I don't know what's happened. I know the old three, you know, tragedy plus time equals comedy, but I don't really
think that. I guess so. Oh, man.
Tomodachi Live starring BJ, directed by Michael Bay. Done.
Yep.
We're out. Everybody's done.
Yeah. That's it.
Oh, I like the idea that they could create an app, a Tomodachi Life for your phone. Oh, they already created that, I guess. Miitomo. Yeah. And in the movie theater, you would just hit submit, and it would just like, okay, we're going to randomly pick characters from people's phones, and then BJ shows
the
up.
Procedurally generated movie. That's a fucking great idea.
Oh, man.
Wow.
Man,
you're a big fan of that concept in general, James, so I would have thought, I'm not surprised that it's you that's advancing it.
Fund it all!
If anybody's ran into BJ out there... take a
you
picture.
Don't just run into BJ's, John.
Take a picture of
you
it.
You don't just run into BJ's.
BJ, we're looking right? for you. We're putting you on the milk carton. We're going to find him. Whatever. Not him, her, whatever it is. The flesh-colored whistle. Find the flesh-colored whistle.
I'm so sorry.
Be a star in your own Zelda game. Find the
flesh-colored
whistle.
We're talking about movies, John.
Next email.
Please.
Next email, please.
Raymond writes, I fear the NX will be an underpowered console that third parties will neglect once again because they won't do the obvious, which would be to build a graphically powerful console with similar architecture to the other consoles, with a standard wireless controller and no forced motion controls, and a standard online capabilities. Do you guys fear they will repeat their mistakes once again? Thanks, guys. I love the podcast. Sincerely, a worried Nintendo gamer.
I mean, starting from the back of that email, like, I don't really have any issues with Nintendo Network right now. Like, I never thought I would make that phrase, but right now, I don't have any explicit issues with Nintendo's online infrastructure.
Yeah, but I think that he maybe just means, like, parity with the other, other networks. And I guess what that means is connectivity with Twitch or whatever.
But, I mean, I guess, but, like, the only if it's just purely online, like, gameplay, the only thing they're really dealing with is voice chat, and that's game by game. You can turn it on if you want to. They don't have party chat, but I'm willing to kind of give that up to not have to pay a monthly fee or a yearly fee. I mean, I don't know that the online part really matters, because it's not super hard to make your game online for Wii U right now, and people just didn't. In fact, there are games that came out on Wii U that they just didn't include the online mode, which is weird.
Yeah, I mean, the counter argument to that is that Nintendo hasn't gone out of their way to really push online in any way, shape, or form.
Sure, but
aside
that's
from a couple of their own titles, like they don't.
Go ahead.
Certainly haven't gotten behind it. There's been no big push.
There's still little frustrations here that we talked about Mario Maker and the fact that, you know, it doesn't kind of automatically, like, have the friends list really thoroughly integrated with the game. So it's like it's spitting out some sort of, I mean, you have a Miiverse feed that and an automated post that will spit out the code of the level that someone's created on your list. But what you don't have within the game itself is something where, you know, like, you do have a watch list of people, you can follow people, but, you know, you have to add your friends manually for that, which seems silly, you know.
It is.
You've already got a friend. It's those sorts of things of just, like, unifying it and integrating it and all that and standardizing it and all. And they've been moving in the right direction for a while, so there probably will be more improvements when we get to NX.
Other games did integrate it correctly. So it's
that's what it's the standardization, isn't it? You know, is that this always happens across the board. That, you know, it is always integrated to the correct extent, you know, with your friends list and with Miiverse and all that kind of, with My Nintendo now, you know, and I would assume, like I said, they will make progress in that direction on NX, and I don't think it'd be anything. There may still be some annoying shortcomings, but probably wouldn't be anything that I'd get terribly vexed about myself, because I'm fairly satisfied with the way things are now. You know, they have made improvements. I think the underpowered point, I mean, what's kind of implicit, I feel like, in this email is something about, you know, the idea that it would end up being underpowered because the way they're going to try and sell it would be some sort of gimmick type of deal, you know, motion controls that are mentioned. But I'm not sure. I mean, I still feel like the main kind of limiting factor on its power is the idea of, well, you know, what is the kind of device that's going to be good for the Japanese market? Mm-hmm. And is that something that's really, really powerful? You know, I mean, PS4 has not blown the doors off in Japan so far. You know, I mean, it's, you know, it will pass Wii U fairly soon, I would assume, on the sales, but those are modest numbers. You know, handheld's where it's at, and you've got to create something, you know, that appeals to that market, because they, you know, that's, you know, it's their domestic market. They probably, you know, some people argue that they prioritize it too much, you know, it's overemphasized in their strategy, but however you want to slice it, it's really important to them. Mm-hmm. You know, so that would be my feeling, is that, you know, if NX is a platform, it could have multiple devices and all that, but ultimately some end of it has got to be a device that appeals to Japan. And I'm not sure that necessarily is something that has parity or near parity with the current lot of the Xbox One and PS4, which of course themselves are becoming a family of systems, the Neo and the freaking Project Tank Scorpio. He sting you with his dreams of power. What the hell is that project name?
I think it could easily be as powerful as the PS4, just because the PS4 is relatively cheap now. It's come down. They're both around $100 in price or less.
Publishers aren't gonna let their devs make games that don't run on the PS4, because that's suicide. That's just saying, I don't want your money. Go away.
Yep.
And in fact, Sony seems pretty insistent that no, if you're gonna make a PS4 game, it's gonna run on the base PS4. Mm-hmm. Microsoft's messaging is all over the goddamn place, but they have different motivations. But they've said the same thing though.
They've said the same thing. No console left behind and all that. So.
Yeah, but they've also said that, well, I mean, you don't have to do it to up your graphics. You could do it for AI stuff, at which point, like, well, is it really the same game at that point if the AI performs dramatically differently on one console versus the other? Not really.
Yeah.
Like they've taken a much more laissez-faire approach, at least in some of their commentary. But still, mm-hmm. like, if it was at that tier, then that's probably fine for the remainder of this generation. But, I mean, sound effect here, please.
We do not currently know what the NX is. We do not currently know what the NX is.
Okay, now that that's done, like, if it is, as Greg says, the family of systems phrase, then you probably don't want your handheld version that powerful, because you are going to nuke the shit out of your battery, potentially.
I mean, the 3DS has long been considered kind of un-Nintendo-like in its battery life. It was not particularly great. To go further than that would seem like a problem. The very poor battery life of the sort of original PSP and the optical media was kind of credited with sinking that for a long time. And I think that's the kind of concern they are sensitive to. So I think you're right about that. I mean, the one thing I would say about repeating their mistakes, the question is kind of the crux of the question. It depends which mistakes you mean, I guess, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't want to make it sound like they've made nothing but mistakes, because we're not that far removed from them having this ridiculously successful DS and Wii and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, 3DS has been a sort of, you know, qualified success.
And it's not the power itself that of the console or lack thereof that makes developers kind of shy away from supporting Nintendo consoles. It's a whole, the fact that people who buy Nintendo systems don't seem to buy third-party software under Nintendo systems, and that's not just the power, that's not just the fidelity of the port, it's also the online, it's what their friends are playing. It's just whatever, like, which console they feel like using for that particular game.
There's a lot of factors that go into it, and I think there's also a certain degree of path dependency, you know, in terms of just you look at what's happened before, you know, and that informs the publisher's decisions, and it informs players' decisions, and you just have the inertia of it, you know, that you get stuck in these kind of equilibria. And the thing is, I mean, the hardware in abstract could be the kind of hardware that would have a more vibrant third-party scene or something like that, potentially, hypothetically, but you know, these sorts of perceptions and, you know, all that kind of stuff that just persist make it harder for it to do that. Having said that, you know, I mean, clearly, if you have a platform that has these barriers to kind of entry in terms of like porting games and stuff, there's no doubt it's going to fare worse in that regard than if it didn't have them. But I mean, for me, boiling it down to the crux of their mistakes in this past phase, both console and portable, was having features, and I think this is, you know, also what the question's getting to, that proved to be, you know, not worth their while in terms of what they added to the price of the product, namely the gamepad on Wii U and the stereoscopic 3D of 3DS. You know, that those increased the price early on and it just got them off on the wrong foot. And obviously they did a whole bunch of stuff with 3DS to try and, you know, kind of gin it up. And we had 2DS and, you know, Monster Hunter and, you know, Circle Pad Pros and all sorts of different things they did to try and rectify the situation. And they had some success with that, but yeah, it did get off to a bad start, and starts matter. You know, I mean, look at Xbox One, and then look at 360.
That was before the start. I mean,
it did the lead in with that. But you look at 360 versus PS3 and then Xbox One versus PS4. I mean, obviously there's a difference in that, you know, the 360 was a year in front of PS3, but yeah, they kind of switch roles in terms of the hubris and the bad PR and the hardware the overpriced, and, you know, Sony was making these bets, you know, was about Blu-ray and the format war, and that kind of jacked up the price of the PS3, and that got that off
to
a bad
start. Ports and
all that weird stuff. And then with Xbox One, it was Kinect and DRM that became the millstone around it. So my point would be, Nintendo is a very different way, but, you know, the stereoscopic 3D and the gamepad, while I very much enjoy both of them, I can see why they put those features in their hardware, because I really like them. But business-wise, you can't justify it in retrospect. It was not a good call. So, but if in terms of avoiding those mistakes, that's the kind of mistake they really need to avoid.
Yeah.
Don't tie anything around its neck that makes it harder to compete in these marketplaces.
Or at least make it optional.
Yeah, well, that's the family assistant thing for me, I think, is that maybe that could be the way in which it's all optional. You know, there's some sort of baseline unit that is affordable, you know, that will play at least the vast majority of the games in some sort of, you know, very perfectly acceptable level or something, you know, and get that entry level thing there. And then, of course, everything else has got to be good. You've got to have a launch lineup that hits the right notes, and there's all this other stuff. But that's the first thing. Just don't handicap yourself with a feature that makes it more expensive than it needs to be, where the customer doesn't see the value added. That would be my first thing. And I would have thought, after the experience of the last two, that would be the first kind of mistake they're going to try and avoid making.
Well, I mean, even back in the Wii days, I mean, also with third parties, I mean, I remember reading stories about how with the Wii, they were like, there hasn't been third parties, what do you want out of our next console? It was, hey, third parties, here's our next console. Have fun. Because I remember, I forget who it was, whether it was Ubisoft or somebody like that, but I remember reading an article where Nintendo came in and they had the specs for the Wii, and they were like, yep, the main thing we want this thing to be is we want it to be small, and we want it to be cool running. Power is not the main thing, and the third party was just kind of like,
I also enjoy cool running.
Okay, it's a great movie. But yeah, I mean, the third, and that's the kind of thing where it just seems like Nintendo was very intent on, like, we're doing this with our console, third parties, you can like it or don't like it, but you're going to have to live with it. So.
Well, I mean, It was weird that generation, because the Cell was basically saying, like, we're going to create this incredibly convoluted processor system.
Yeah, but at least it could match, you know, what the 360 was doing.
It could.
What, like, capability-wise, right?
Not for, like, half the generation.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, yeah.
What a fucking nightmare that generation must have been if you were a developer.
Oh, yeah.
Like, just constant nonsense from everybody.
Well, that's why, I mean, you saw games come out on the 360, because they're just like, we don't even want to, like, look at PS3 right now.
Right. You know? This is so much easier.
Yep.
Well, all right, so I believe that is going to do it for email this week. You can send us your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, like these gentlemen did. That's usually how I end that intro of that segment. I didn't say it last time, so there it is.
Smooth. Smooth as usual, James.
Yeah, and in fact, that's going to do it for this week. So, Greg.
Yes.
Do we have some exit music?
We do. It's been an historic day. I have to say, the 20th anniversary of the launch of the N64 in Japan, of course, I'm referring to.
Yep.
I did consider some N64 sort of music.
Why would you do that?
But, you know, to be fair, we did do the 15th anniversary episode back on the appropriately sort of numbered 264 episode, you know, so, and that has N64 music at the end of it.
A 5-year-old 15th anniversary episode.
Yeah, and then there's the, you know, the N64 episode that was done without us, of course, that started it all back in episode, like, 89 or whatever, and that has Lords of Thunder at the end of it, so who needs N64
music? It has the Lords of Thunder cast at the end of it, thank you.
So, ultimately, I did not go with it, but if you've got some particular N64 requests or anything from that era, I'd certainly be happy to hear them. Yeah, so this is actually a request from Klex Yoshi, it ties into my new business, obviously. It's Fire Emblem Fates music, Road Taken. Very nice. I didn't hear the music all that much playing the game, but what I heard of it was great. And this is very nice, so enjoy.
And on that, it's time to end the show. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Time to put my pants back on.
God damn it!
Bye-bye. Thank you.
there are too many games.
Seriously.
Yeah, that's so weird. I've talked about this on off air. This is the part of the summer where it's too hot for James. It's you've got some big hitters coming in quick succession for you.
God, if Ace Attorney 6 had come out this month too, I would have to quit work.
Over here, it's been unseasonably cold, actually. So, you know, maybe it's just not too hot. It's just so the games came in. I don't know. It's lame. Wow, I'm gonna cut this out.
You don't get to cut out your awkward moments and leave everybody else's.
Oh, but I do.
While you're eating. Are you eating during the show? God damn it.
I'm muting myself.
God damn it.
Keep digging.
Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 482. I'm your host, James Jones. With me today is Mr. Greg Leahy. Hello, Greg.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
Also with me today is John Skyward Sword Lindemann. Hello, John.
Nice to be here.
Also with me today is Guillaume Vaillette, who's probably going to edit the second intro out. Hello, Guillaume.
Well, yeah, I will. I'm sorry. I'm done eating. All right, let's get to business.
Respect my artistic vision.